Oh, several years ago in Sunyata Nikaya, we read the following: the inner tangle and the outer tangle. This generation is entangled in a tangle. And so I ask Gautama this question: who, Lord Buddha, succeeds in disentangling the tangle? Buddha said, when a wise man established in virtue develops consciousness and understanding, he succeeds in disentangling the tangle. Just as a solid mass of rock remains unshaken by the wind, so too, in the face of blame and praise, the wise remain immovable. So I thought about that. I heard someone talk about it earlier this week, and my root teacher, Michael Winner, was one of his favorite teachings, this inner tangle and this outer tangle. And it's particularly fascinating at this time because of the line in there that says, this generation is entangled and entangled. And I think most of us can look around where we're living today in terms of the country, in terms of politics, in terms of education and economic justice, and we can make the whole list. And we could say this generation is indeed entangled in a tangle, internal and external. And I think that applies to our spiritual practice as well. And so that's one of the reasons I was fascinated by it. Last weekend, I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts that looks at socially responsible media. And the headline of the particular podcast was "Goodbye Sharing Economy, Hello Isolation Economy." And I don't know if you've been keeping up with, they continue to try to market things for us. But the idea now is that the ways in which they are distributing the news and entertainment, new ideas, and of course selling things to us, is all based on more and more and more people are spending more and more time at home in front of their screens. And so instead of bringing paper today, I brought this to honor that new phenomenon. And I start out by reminding folks that I'm 73, so at some point this will probably shut off and we'll have a short talk again at least because I'll have no idea how to fix it. I think for us, this idea that there's an algorithm out there that folks have been working on for very smart people have been working on for a while to help to figure out what it is we're interested in, how long we stay interested in, and what besides interest, what will get us to do something about that, to change an opinion or to buy something or to affiliate with some individual or organization. And so there's the idea that I think when this was written back in that in down in the middle of discourses, I think the idea was that there was the internal tangle, like who am I and how do I want to be in the world and what kind of practice do I want to have as a spiritual person and how do I want to relate to others in my sangha, in my family, my teacher, his or her teacher. Of course, they would all have been his teacher back then, but that was the internal tangle, was the things that a person was dealing with on an internal basis, that could involve a lot of planning and worrying and anxiety, and then a lot of hopefully doing some self-reflection, arousing some mindfulness, and then taking some action. And then, of course, lots of rumination and worry afterwards that we've done the wrong thing, not done it well enough, done it too well. Now people would be expecting things from me, et cetera, et cetera. So there was all that internal tangle. And then, as now, there was the external tangle. If I decided to be Buddhist and everybody else around me was a Hindu or some, whatever. There's that, and what does the government want of me? What does my family want of me? What does the established order in the community want from me? And so I had the opportunity to say, so I get to figure out who I want to be, and then I get to figure out who I want to be in the eyes of others, and then I get to figure out that who I am as a social being in the community. It's all very complicated, and the line between what was the internal. What was the internal tangle and the external tangle could become quite difficult to discern how much influence how much am I influenced by the laws and the structures of my community and so forth. So one of the things that happens for me and for probably for most of us is that we find ourselves entangled in our angers and our fears, our frustrations and our anxieties. And these feelings, these mental formations result in behaviors, right? And these are behaviors that we have that we think are to protect ourselves or our loved ones or if we're in Sangha, our Sangha members, designed to protect, we think. They can be behaviors that are designed to soothe pain that I'm in, the pain that I see someone else in, that I interpret someone else must be in that pain because I would be in pain if I was sitting in that chair. Designed for that. And then behaviors that I refer to as to calm the storms. So many of these are not well thought out responses to internal or external tangles, but they become automatic behaviors. You know, things like, are you an extrovert or an introvert? Do you actually know if you are? Because I think a lot of us go through life thinking one or the other, only to find out later that that was not the case. Are we somebody who, when there's an emergency or an event, a mental health event or a physical health event, are we somebody who responds immediately to help? Or are we somebody who reasonably, in some cases, backs up and allows the event to happen and witnesses or assumes that somebody else will step in and take care of it? I'm not saying either one of those is right or wrong, but which of those are we? And then afterwards, whichever one of those we were, you get home that night, lock the door, and sit down in your chair or on your tafu and think, how was I today? What kind of human being was I today? Did I respond effectively? If I tried to help somebody with a physical or mental health event that was going on in their life, did I make things better? Was I neutral or did I make things worse? And what will I do next time? And that, of course, is a reasonable reflection, as long as it's a reasonable reflection. And then for many of us, it turns into, oh, my God, I could have done better. I should have done this. I shouldn't have done that, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, mental health events. I live in San Francisco. I know there's going to be another one tomorrow in the coffee shop or on Muni or somewhere. What will I do the next time? And so that tangle continues to weave like vines in the jungle, right? So in his teaching about this particular teaching about the internal and the external tangle, Bhikkhu Bodhi said, in this generation, and he was not writing then or now, almost everyone seems to be seeking to satisfy his own desires. Almost everybody seems to be in conflict with somebody else. And then he went on to say, perhaps everyone else. I'm struggling anxiously to get what each one thinks he or she wants, only to get it and not be sure if they want it. And then, you know, I think that's a really interesting phenomenon for all of us. It's in Buddhism, we often talk about a goal, perhaps, or an intention. Intention is probably a better word. To deal with desires. Lots of books on the bookshelf upstairs or in the libraries or at home or sitting next to your bed or in your library someplace, dealing with desires and how to work with desires and aim desires and in some cases suggestions to lead a desire-free life, if you will. And what most of those books result in is us reading maybe the whole thing if you're a really good student, but in most cases the first and third and last chapters and putting it back on the shelf and thinking, well, on a good day that's not possible, and on most days I'm not even sure that it would make for an interesting or useful life. You know, we have desires for fresh air so we can breathe, desires for nutrition so we can do what it is we need to do. Desires for good company, you know, for people that are interesting, that care about us, that motivate us, that bring us new ideas. We have desires for them. And then, you know, the person next to you at the table in your home or your community or at the coffee shop is not interested today or maybe ever, but they want to talk anyway. you're wanting to read something, or you're wanting to silently reflect, or you're wanting to focus on your cup of coffee, and this person wants to talk anyway. So how does the desire to have interesting people in your life and the desire to be present for other beings, for all sentient beings, right? To live and be lived for all beings, how does that merge at that point? And so then there's another tangle. And I think part of it is that I'll speak for me, entangled with mental images, right? So I have a vision of myself after many years as a student of the Buddha, as a disciple of the Buddha, continually reflecting and continually trying to arouse wisdom and compassion in my dealings with other people. Mm-hmm. And then the truth is that on some days, when it's been raining for 3 days, I'm a fussy old queen and I want to be left alone. And so I went to my second home, the coffee shop up on the corner, this morning, and to be left alone to just reflect about what we might talk about today. And everybody that came in there wanted to have a chat, wanted to stop by the table and share with me their most exciting news of the week, which was that it rained all week and they managed to survive to Saturday. And they wanted to share the strategies that they used to do that. I say with love and compassion, not one word of it was interesting. So the tangle, the mental tangle comes up. How do you embrace these brothers and sisters and others and be interested in them and interested in what they seemed? It was almost like they'd all just come from a rain meeting or something. They all were all excited about this stuff going on. And I don't know if you know, but we evidently had a Pineapple Express and an atmospheric river this week. And it's still not interesting. Anyway, so the tangle is, how do I live with my bodhisattva vows? And how do I live with my own desires and needs to surround myself with stimulating, interesting people? Because part of my story, part of my mental image is that if I surround myself with interesting, stimulating people, I'm more likely to be one myself. Because we learn, in my experience, we learn from the people that we choose to talk to and carry on with. So in interpersonal relationships, people often come together because they have various needs or things in common. We've all come here because we're Buddhists. So does Zen practitioners, and because this is a place we like to practice. And so we all have ideas about what this means. And if we handed out a little slip of paper right now and said to everyone, what brought you here and why are you still here? We fill those out promising that no one will try to figure out your penmanship. We're not going to do it. But the answers, there would be 12 different answers for sure on those pieces of paper, or maybe 8 different answers. A couple of us might hit on the same thing. But in society and in our sanghas and in our communities and in our families, we're presented with this palette of conflicting ideas and different ideas. And we have this. Whoever that dog was. We have this, all these different ideas. And we try to figure out, are we being stimulated and interested and given some new information or a new view on some information? And so we can change our thoughts and we can think about these things. So that's really interesting. And I think about the advice that I've been given in my life a lot in the last couple of decades, here and in my recovery world, which is two things. One, to live in the present moment. To live in this present moment. And then the other one that I hear frequently is to do the next right thing. And so if I'm really in a quiet mood and I think about those two primary pieces of advice that I'm given over and over again, and that I give over and over again to people that I work with as students or sponsees in recovery or clients in therapy, it's like, do those two things actually go together? If somebody's in a tough space right now and I say, most important thing, just live in this present moment. And then they talk a little bit more and I say, yes, it's important to figure out to do the next right thing. It's like, now or next? What is it now or next? And then I think I've shared here before that I was at a wonderful talk that Thich Nhat Hanh gave a few years back when he was still alive. And he said, we all focus on this present moment. And then he giggled and said, too late. This moment just left. Oh. And so all around the room, people that have paid a lot of money over the years to go to workshops and lectures and invested in their Buddhist practice, only to have Thich Nhat Hanh say, not the present moment. The present moment is already gone. So that was just a very interesting concept. It's like, which of those two things, are they in conflict or are they not? Can we sit and arouse mindful awareness? And can we have some concentration and some insight? Can we, as we get up off the cushion or out of our chairs, take that mind and zazen with us into the rest of our lives and say, okay, the next right thing is the things that I would do as a bodhisattva, as a disciple of the Buddha, that are in the interest of my fellows, the interest of the Sangha, the interest of the community. So probably not in conflict with each other. Well, Norman Fisher, in fact, says that it's beyond self and other. It's beyond inside and outside, beyond enjoyment or lack of enjoyment. He says that our practice is really, particularly when we're meditating in zazen, to just being alive. And what does that mean? Norman says that it means to be embodied, breathing, and conscious. Your life depends on these gifts. Most of us are so busy that we hardly take notice of these human experiences. And so I think that's part of, you know, when I think about this, the algorithms that they're developing to tell us what we are interested in, for how long we're going to be interested, and what will take us to the next interest when we click, they count the number of times we click. And that sort of thing, it's like, well, if our primary practice in Soto Zen is Zazen, it's to sit and to be just in this moment, to be with the feeling of being alive, to be open to whatever is presented, whatever comes up, and then not to hang on to it, to let it go. So seems to me then that it's in that, and there's a huge amount of commercial meditation and some commercial Buddhism, certainly lots of commercial mindfulness activities out there, where the worlds of spiritual life in the Buddha and the benefits of Zazen have been mixed with the concepts of commercialism and how we do all that. So, you know, some of us need and like to have rules and structures. We like to study the history of things. We like specific instructions, books, magazines, articles. And we like to be around other people so that we can watch and compare, often negatively, right? How other people are practicing, how other people are sitting, their posture, the degree that folks breathing sounds, if they're on either side of us, like it's regular deep breathing, Zen breathing. In my first few years of Buddhist practice, my teacher, Dai Ru, Michael Winger, said to me, as I've shared that before, he said, stop reading. For 1 year, no reading Buddhist books or articles and no going to workshops. And I said, what? And he said, just experience. I want you to just experience Zazen. I want you to just experience engaged Buddhism, doing for others, doing with others. Just sit, he said, and welcome concentration and insight. Let it wash over you and through you. Be one with your breathing. Let your body and mind fall away. And of course, my response to that was, sure, that's going to happen, right? Eventually over the course of the next year, some of it did happen, but not a lot. A teacher named Sengaku Matsuka taught it this way. In Zen, we say one should have an empty mind without desire or seeking, and one which is filled with wisdom and compassion for the welfare and enlightenment of others. So when I heard that, I thought, wow, that's really a wonderful challenge. A mind that is empty without desire or seeking, but a mind at the same time that is filled with wisdom and compassion for the welfare and enlightenment of others. One practices meditation, he says, so that they will discover the Buddha at the very core of your being. So that's pretty powerful stuff, that when we're trying to reach that place of being empty, then what we will find at that emptiness, we will find at that emptiness is our Buddha nature. And that Buddha nature isn't just blank. It isn't, the lack of busyness, the lack of movement, the lack of the wheels of my brain twirling as fast as they possibly can, the lack of my heart and mind being completely out of touch with each other because they're both busy doing other things. What he's teaching is that what we find is our Buddha nature. And our Buddha nature, as we have been taught, is the nature of being concerned, of discovering that welfare and enlightenment of others is our primary motivation for action. He says, if we are never still, we can never get to the core where our Buddha nature is. So he went on to say one last thing, which I'll share with you, which is that many people who study Zen fall into the trap of chasing words. In Zen, he says, we believe that this truth, this Buddha nature, is to be found within us, and that is there from the beginning, and it can only be found within us, and no one else can show it to us. So that was his view, right? No one else can show it to us. I think we can show it to each other, and I think teachers and others can help us to see it more clearly. But they would sort of be the ophthalmologists of spiritual life, right? It's there. We're not seeing it because probably we're too busy. We're not seeing it because we're being bombarded constantly by information. But it's there, and we can see it. Earlier this week, I was in another talk by someone, and they shared with us a discourse from the Blue Cliff Record, Case 43, and it's Dongshan's Heat and Cold, it's called. And so I'll just talk about that for a couple seconds. But a monk asked Master Dongshan, cold and heat descend upon us. How can we avoid them? Dongshan answered, why don't you go to the place where there is no cold or heat? The monk was confused, and he said, where is this place where there is no cold or heat? Dongshan said, when it is cold, let it be so cold that it kills you. When it is hot, let it be so hot that it kills you. And he went silent. So does everybody, about koans? They're like little cases or riddles that you're supposed to figure out. So when it is, where is the place with no heat or cold? Dongshan said, when it is cold, let it be so cold that it kills you. When it is hot, let it be so hot that it kills you. So all of you, by show of hands, who understand, have an answer to that koan? Okay, so first of all, part of the idea of koans, so that everyone can feel comfortable, is there is not an answer. That most of us, if we were being honest, probably thought something about what that means. And the reason I brought it up today is because I have been to two different sanghas in two different states in the last month where, for some reason, this case came up, and now this makes three. And in both cases, in those other sanghas, the conversation went on, if I add it all up, in those two places for about 3 hours. Everybody had an idea about what it meant. And as each person spoke, in both cases, there were revered teachers, not me, not speaking, talking about this. If people wanted to, get the approval of the teacher, they wanted to get the approval of the assembly. And so they had all sorts of ideas about what heat and cold meant and where you might find a place that was neither hot nor cold. Or what the idea of killing, translated in other places as consume you, let it consume you. And so maybe some of you had answers too. And the fact is that when we study koans, it's to get us out of our fixed view. So whatever I thought when I first heard that, and for me, when I study koans, when I first hear a case like that, my first response is, who cares? And my mind starts to whirl and think, oh, dear God, we're going to spend an hour or three talking about this, and no one cares. But I listen to people being interested and aroused by the spiritual curiosity, by the what does this mean, and what was this koan trying to teach? It's still confusing to me. But the fact that many of the people that spoke in both places that I was at said, well, I've been in places. Somebody said, I've been in places. I was in, I think it was Texas last year, and it was 103 degrees, and I was literally dying. I was dying from the heat. And somebody else said that they had been in Chicago when it was, 0 degrees and 13 below with the wind chill factor, and they were literally dying from the cold. And then, of course, the next speaker said, but you're here. You did not die. So you certainly did not literally die because you're still here. And that, in a way, we went. But I think what's important about that is that oftentimes we're eager with koans to come up with an answer that satisfies us, that gets a response from our teacher or our colleagues if we're studying it in a group. Or that in my case, we'll bring the study of the koan to an end so we'll do something else. But we're all eager to have some sort of a response. And oftentimes that response is what we think our opinion should be in the particular setting we're in, maybe based on who the teacher is and what his or her there dealing with koans is. So the impulse that we have to have an answer and to have it be an approved answer really speaks to that concept that, you know, we're out here in the world or we're here in our Sangha and we're trying to be the true person that we are. We're trying to find our true Buddha nature. And we're trying to be members of what in the koan study is partially at least an intellectual exercise. So we want to carry our own weight. We want to feel like we fit in and have answers. And we want some approval. You know, if we make an opinion, I was watching people, the most recent one, someone would offer opinion. They'd start out tentatively and nervously, and they'd look around the room, and they'd be waiting for some nods and smiles and say, yeah, that makes sense. And one of the things I know, and you probably all know, is that if I said to you that an apple has three legs, several of you in the room would nod and smile and think, oh, he's got a point somehow there, because we're kind to each other. And no one wants to say that man's had too much coffee and apples do not have legs and what the hell is he talking about? So what would happen in these groups was that somebody would give an answer and they were tentative at first and then people would say, yeah, I get that. And then they'd go, you know, then they'd really get into it and carry on. And so I think that part of what we're talking about with this tangle that we get into, koan studies are good because it's a good example, a good way to think about that. Because we get this opportunity to it's presented as a case. And the scholars of koans really resent it when we say like a riddle. It's almost like a riddle. We're not supposed to think of it that way. It's a case that's presented with some basic facts, and we are asked to respond to the basic facts. And we usually do that with our fixed views. And the teacher will say no to whatever we say at first, because there's this opportunity to think again, to reflect some more, to arouse some more insight and see what you come up with. And so that is a lot like how we live in our lives, you know, coming up with an idea that we have that might be based, as I mentioned before, on protecting ourselves or those around us, might be done to soothe some pain that we've had before, might be done hopefully for some pleasure once in a while. But we have some ways that we respond to things. And you know, oftentimes it's based on what we're, you know, often people say it's based on our lived experience. And I think the reality is that it's based on our lived experience and it's based on the stories we have told ourselves about that experience. You know, we have an event, I think of an example of going on a vacation. We allowed Johnny to make, is anybody in here named Johnny? We allowed Johnny to make the reservation and he looked in a magazine and found a cottage that would be perfect for the number of people that were going and had a nice picture and a beautiful view of the lake and a fire burning in the fireplace. It was just gorgeous. And so we all said, okay, packed up, got in the car and went there. And that beautiful picture was taken in 1957 and it's now 2024. If you put a fire in that fireplace, the entire cabin might burn down. After they took that picture in 1957, they also conducted the last thorough cleaning of the building. And so there we are on vacation. We are next to a beautiful lake and there's a mountain behind us and we're five friends. And so in my life, having had an experience like that, I years ago, can remember very clearly that I thought it would be great fun to be as sarcastic and rude about this cabin as I could possibly be, and threatened to call the health department and threatened to burn it down, and suggest that Johnny not become a travel agent and blah, 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 blah. And some people were laughing at first, you know, some of the sarcastic jokes were kind of funny. And at some point, even I back then, without much of a spiritual life and probably not in recovery as I recall, although I can't figure out the time frame, but even I at some point figured out, you know what, we spent a lot of money, so we're going to be here for 4 days, whether I keep talking like this or perhaps, you know, suggest that maybe we go outside on the front porch and appreciate the beauty of the view of the lake, where there were two relatively brand new boats that people could go on the lake with if you were interested in rowing a boat on a lake, and that sort of thing. And then maybe, as somebody else suggested, maybe instead of complaining and being miserable, maybe we take the next hour and a half of our 4 days, take an hour and a half and clean the place up and organize it differently and, you know, figure out how to make this place a livable place so that we can have 3.5 great days of vacation together. And I think that's the beginning of this, how do the wise who live with an ethical life, and that ethical life, of course, in Buddhism would be living and being loved by all sentient beings. So how do we stop from getting all bound up in this is horrible and I don't like it, and shouldn't have let you make the decision? It's like, it doesn't matter, the decision is made. And so, you know, we don't just roll over. I think in that case, it would be perfectly reasonable not to have Johnny make any more reservations. But berating him at this point isn't going to help, and being miserable for 4 days isn't going to help. And so how do we not get bound up by our fears and our standard behaviors? And how do we use that koan of the bad vacation rental as an opportunity to say, how else could we respond? You know, we're five friends who have come away together to live together for 4 or 5 days. And so how do we take this as an opportunity to think about ways that we could live in family or in Sangha in different ways, in ways that encourage solutions rather than focusing on the problems. And, you know, I think it gives us a great opportunity to not just go with the algorithm. What do I like? And if I don't like this, I want something else, and I want it right now. And to really begin to say, let's take some time to figure out how we can have our Buddhist practice, our spiritual life, be more than something that I do on Saturday morning, or more than something that I do for 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week, but that it could actually be the way I live. I had a note that I was going to share with you earlier that just came up here, so I'll share it with you now, just so we can all be equally amused. A study came out in PC Magazine, which is an industry magazine for technology, and it said in 2023, based on their survey work, on average, people spend 4 hours and 25 minutes on their phones each day, and that the average individual, here's the fun one, checks their cell phone 144 times a day. 144 times a day. And the interesting thing about that is that that number has actually gone down from 2022, because checking your cell phone meant picking it up and turning it on. And cell phone use has gone up. There's some percentage that's in here somewhere that has actually gone up, cell phone use, because people don't turn them off. Like if you're sitting at your desk or you're sitting in your reading or watching television, people have it next to them and it's just turned on all the entire time. So that doesn't have anything to do with what I was just saying, but that note just popped up on here for some reason. And I think it's again, it's how our brains are being taught, younger generations for sure, because they're being raised in that kind of technology. And even those of us across the lifespan, it's the way our brains are being fed information. What do I like? If I don't like it, I'm going to click and go to something else. And if I can't click and go to something else, I'll cancel that streaming service and get another one. You know, needs and desires. And so when that transfers to like the vacation scenario that I just pointed out, it's like, oh, well, what about my needs? My needs would be to get out of this cabin and get away from this however awful it was supposed to be in my mind on that first day and other people's minds. Never mind what Johnny feels like. Never mind the money we've spent. Never mind that people really wanted a calm, peaceful, quiet vacation on the lake. And I was in those first hours, and several of the other people, busy creating as much drama as possible under the guise that it might be humorous. So I think our Buddhist teaching that did come into play finally at that vacation rental, and more often in my life these days, is that inner peace is the key. Inner peace is the key. In a state of mind of inner peace, we can face difficulties with more calm and more reason. And so our Buddhist practice and our Zazen practice becomes really important. You know, some of us have been in sanghas where there's been conflict in the sangha. And one of the things that happens is we rush to find the solution to that conflict. And we come up with the very right answer, and then we get stuck on it, you know, just like with the koan. I know the answer to that. Here's what we're going to do. And then other people either agree with that or don't agree with it. And the mob mentality has formed, and off we go. And one of the things that a wise teacher would say to us is, you know what? We need to slow down. We need to slow down and think about all of the people that are involved in the conflict. And we need to bring peace and ease for all of the people. And so how do we do that? And certainly, I think that the peace and ease and being mindful is one of the answers to that. That it's not just, as I say, something we do three times a week or every Saturday morning, but it gets to become the way that we live. And we see senior teachers who seem to be peaceful and living in ease most of the time. It's my experience, meaning from watching and being with people, that those are people that do exactly that, that walk through life saying, things aren't always exactly the way I want them. And maybe I grouse about them a little bit, but the fact is I continue walking and I find ways. I find groups of people to be with. I find places to go where people share some of my desires and things that I'm interested in. And together we can build communities. Mindfulness says, do I still need those old behaviors of mine? Is there a more skillful way for me to be today? Based on these, is there a way for me not just to be okay? Is there a way for me to be the person who lives with ethics and morality and wisdom and compassion and actively engage in untangling the tangles that we live in? The guy that wrote Charlotte's Web, E.B. White, said, there's no limit to how complicated things can get on account of one thing always leading to another. Right? Pretty simple stuff. Pretty simple stuff. I think I might stop there and we can have some discussion if we want. I'll just share with you a poem that I know you've heard before. It's by Gunilla Norris and it's called Paradox. It is a paradox that we encounter so much internal noise when we first try to sit in silence. It is a paradox that experiencing pain releases pain. It is a paradox that keeping still can lead us so fully into life and being. Our minds do not like paradoxes. We want things to be clear so we can maintain our illusions of safety. Our illusions of safety. Certainty breeds tremendous smugness. We each possess a deeper level of being, however, which loves paradox. It knows that in summer, that summer is already growing like a seed in the depths of winter. It knows that in summer, a seed is already growing like a seed in the depths of winter. It knows that the moment we are born, we begin to die. Paradox knows that all of life shimmers in shades of becoming, that shadows and light are always together, that visible mingles with invisible. When we sit in stillness, we are profoundly active. Keeping silent, we hear the roar of existence through our willingness to be one, the one that we are. Through our willingness to be the one that we are, we become one with everything. And so I think internal tangle, external tangle, we are all caught in these tangles. And as it said in the original koan, what do we do about that? And the Buddha said, what you do about that is you behave in a way that is morally upright, kind, compassionate. And who can untangle the tangle? And the Buddha said, you can. You can. It is an invitation to all of us. When we see conflict, when we're in conflict, when we create conflict, when we're bumped by conflict that others are having, our opportunity is to say, how can I, using my commitment to ethical behavior, my commitment to morality, my commitment to wisdom and compassion, how can I help untangle? So it's no longer just a passive experience of what's going on, but it's a willingness to take up the Buddha's invitation to be the one who untangles the tangle. Thank you. And we have a little bit of time for a question or two or a thought or a tangle. Yes.
I was thinking about, well, Michael and I were talking about pets, or at least I was pushing the conversation about pets earlier. And I was thinking about, my head, I kind of often have this sort of image like this, although the pet one just got overlaid now, like when a dog has something it's not supposed to have, and you're like telling him, drop it. I've been finding myself trying to do that a lot, you know, which I think is a good thing, because I certainly get caught up in words. I get very caught up in storylines, especially involving my traumas of past, which has been coming up a lot for me of recent past. And labels too. At some point here, I was talking to someone who's not here, but part of the song, about my Myers-Briggs, or actually I think it was my DISC assessment, Myers-Briggs on steroids. And, you know, I'm this person, and it felt like a little bit of criticism, but now I kind of appreciate that they said, I don't know why you're clinging to those like labels. And since then, I've even read articles that it's not healthy for introverts to run around saying, I'm an introvert sometimes, because they're just reaffirming that and then making excuses for behaviors oftentimes, or and the same with extroverts too, right? Like, I do this because I'm an extrovert. I do this because I'm an extrovert. So it's been kind of interesting to watch me, trying to drop it, hanging on to those stories, hanging on to those labels, even certain words that seem to turn into labels. And I've been, just like this last month, having enough reason to really face them heavily, because I love a nice, tidy, like most of us, a nice, tidy label, nice, tidy package of, oh, you're that, I know all the rest, you know, or this is that, I've seen this kind of before, you know all the rest. And unfortunately, because I've been hanging around with a person who's been kind of encouraging me to say, maybe I'm not, maybe that's not what's going on here. You know, maybe you're down the road on a certain storyline that is not really the storyline. And it's been tough, I'll say that, to drop it, you know.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think I remember Jack Kornfield always, when he was teaching meditation practice, he would always say, think of your mind as a puppy, call it Bodhi. And whenever your mind starts to wander, just gently say, sit, Bodhi. He said, provided you're not somebody who spanks puppies and puts them in the newspaper, just sit, Bodhi. Just sit, gently. And so I think we'll add to that now, that we're older dogs now, so we say, drop it. Yeah, but gently, right? Because I think you're absolutely right. I think we all have, you know, labels, you know, we're a Democrat or Republican, we're a Buddhist or an atheist, or we're both, or, you know, we're, you know, and then the formal ones, you know, we're trauma survivors, which is basically everybody these days, often quite correct. But, you know, trauma survivors or whatever we are, people in recovery, we all have labels. And I think why I mentioned, like you said, extrovert and introvert, it's like we all know that over the last 10 years, the research on that has been phenomenal. And it's like I, my whole life, thought it was a noisy, good fellow, Irish kid, the Irish drinker, best stories in town, always invited to parties to entertain everyone. And later discovered in the later years of that drinking, it was to make a fool of myself so everybody else would have something to laugh at. But nonetheless, I thought I was a happy, good fellow. And so what it actually turned out is, you know, the definitions, one of the definitions is an extrovert is somebody who gets energy from the crowd and therefore feels really great. An introvert is somebody who can do the crowd thing, but it's an expense. So is it nurturing? Is it neutral? Is it depleting? But all of those, the scale that you mentioned just went right out of my head, MMBI.
Myers-Briggs.
We all have those, and you know, tests we've taken, or you know, I did a career test and it said I should be a belly dancer or a nun or something, you know, whatever it is, and we get attached to those. And I think we get attached to them because it's shorthand, right?
Yeah,
it's the shorthand, it's the stories we tell and we do. I mentioned here before that I did a lot of work working with street youth for years and years and years. And you would go to these agencies and they would say, we run a completely non-judgmental program. And it's like, well, first of all, that would mean that you're in a coma. Because we all have judgments, you know. Is that person safe? Is that person likely to have a mental health event? So we should be aware that we can help out. Is that person dangerous? Basic things that we judge, you know. And then as members of society, we say, are these, you know, is this somebody who I want to spend time with? Is this person going to be interesting and stimulating? And we judge that. You know, it is the nature of the human mind that we do it just by laying eyes on the person. Yeah. You know, or listening to the first couple sentences they say. And I think this practice and what you're suggesting, which is so correct, is that, in this practice, we get to sit and be still. And if we get still, then we get to that Buddha nature that says, of course, all of you are interesting people. And let me just suspend that judgment until I have some reason to make some different kinds of action decisions. And in the meantime, I think those labels are all, it's just shorthand. And at some point in our lives, particularly those who are trauma survivors, it was important. Those were survival skills. And as Pema Chodron says, now you get to take a look like it's a beautiful crystal ball. And then you decide, oh, it was beautiful and necessary, and now it's not, and get rid of it. So I think that's the gift of untangling the tangle, is like, nope, don't need to keep that. Yeah. Thank you, Graham.
We have an electronic question.
John. Hey.
From the old country.
Japan or Canada? Which one?
Hi. Excuse me.
Can we hear you?
Can you hear me okay? No?
You're on mute, John.
No, he's not.
Computer. It's not speaking though. I can see his mouth.
Hello.
Oh, now it is.
Ah, yeah, okay.
Okay, the speaker was wrong.
Oh, it's in the
wrong.
There you go.
There.
Yeah, I hear you. My question or request is, I had this nice rakusu. I sewed it from fabric that was a navy blue sheet from an Airbnb, and it wore out pretty fast, but I like it, and it's not threadbare, but if I wear it anymore, it's going to break in a lot of places. So I store bought one when I was in Japan, and Reverend Mule gave me a ring, and I think of this as being the kind of thing that a priest, that she would wear, but it's navy blue. I bought it blue on purpose, but it's the kind that's the store-bought kind. So I'm afraid that it will look like, oh, if I wear this, then I'm saying, I'm pretending I'm a priest, but I'm not. I didn't, you know, it's a layperson's. I'm wearing it. My intention is to wear it as a layperson, because that's who I am at this time. So is it okay if I put it on or I don't know.
Well, this is actually Reverend Mio's temple, so.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
All right. Dies, I get up. Okay, thank you very much. I'm in Canada.
Great, you're back in Canada.
Yep.
It's nice. Any other questions? Fashion tips.
In regards to koan introspection, if one is interested in that sort of thing. I think, you know, the most fruitful way to approach that would be for that activity, rather than to be the beginning point of ruminations about, oh, does the dog have Buddha nature or whatever it might be, that it's the starting point for further deep inquiry into such things as, who is this person that's cold? What is the nature of hot and cold and my perception of it? And that sort of thing. And, you know, not, like I said, not ruminating, not really thinking about it, but just can I be the person that's sitting here miserable because I'm freezing to death, and be that person totally?
Yeah, I think, thank you. I absolutely, I've been practicing now for 30 years this year. And Michael Winger loves koans. As you know, he's written a couple books of them himself. And so whenever he wanted to punish me, whenever he wanted to like deepen my practice, he would get out one of those koans, the Book of, and then when I got more into the recovery movement, he would get out the Book of Serenity, which has nothing to do with recovery, you know, but he would say, here, pick one of these. You can, and I would listen to folks, particularly Rinzai folks who study koans. One guy said, I've been studying the same koan for 18 years. And I had a mini reaction to that back in the old days too. Now I'd be kind and nice, but I thought, 18 years, what the hell's wrong with you? I wouldn't say that, right? What I learned first that helped me was a version of that, which is I have a fixed answer when somebody reads any one of the koans, does a dog have Buddha nature? My answer was, who cares? It's like, but I had an immediate answer. And what I learned from being taught through the process and experiencing the process was, I wouldn't have an immediate answer. You know, sit, breathe, think about it, and then figure out what are the many ways you could look at this case, and think about it, such as, who is the person that's cold or hot? What does that mean? And the language in there, which is, let the heat kill you or let the cold kill you. And then at the last session of that, people were discussing, well, you know, the practical matter, you don't actually die at 103 or, you know, 0 degrees. And that all went on and said, no, that's not, what else? What else can we learn about the person that wrote this, the people that are reading it, the people that are discussing it? And so for me, what took me 2 decades after I finally was willing to read some of them, what took me 2 decades was not to have a fixed response. And for me, not for others, but for me, not to spend a lot of time working on koans by myself, but to discuss them with other people and to discuss them with a teacher. And then lo and behold, I became one, and now people want to talk about koans with me. So the challenge continues, but I do think you're exactly right that it's the gift of a koan, the invitation of a koan is to we always say to get rid of fixed views. And then the fact of the matter is that if we've been around spiritual life for a while, if we've been Buddhist for a while, we also, we don't have any fixed views. We're well beyond that. But I know for me and people I've been talking to a lot lately, we do have an immediate response. Like, there's an immediate response, and then we usually think, does a dog have Buddha nature? Well, of course, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. And then it's like, no, so we know. That was my first answer, so that can't be right. And I'm not going to say that out loud because that would be wrong. So let me say, maybe, you know, and on we go. Yeah. But I think koan practice can be a gift when approached with peace and ease and tranquility. And for me personally, it's a gift that's much better done with other voices rather than just mine. So I don't know if I think it sounded like you work pretty well on your own.
It's a neat expression.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's a good first answer. I like that. Any other thoughts or questions? Anything you'd like us to untangle for you?
Just a quick thought. It's good to bear in mind that when people speak of Kana Zen or traditional koan introspection, that's not what we're talking about. And if you want a real introduction to it, read Unwon's introduction to the koan, so-called Mu. And then that's what they're talking about when they say koan introspection. Studying our Zen stories is a different approach, and just as fruitful, but it is different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to keep that in mind.
And do you offer that here at this temple from time to time?
The old-fashioned, absolutely not.
No.
We do the other kind.
Put together.
Yeah. In fact, people know I don't use the word koan very much anymore. I just call them our sand campfire tales.
Yeah.
And they are like all campfire tales, if they're having any meaning or use, they're rooted somewhere much deeper than our habitual mind.
Yeah, and I think that goes along with everything we talked about today, because they are the campfire tales. And what that means is that, you know, like this game we used to play in middle school, I would tell the koan to you and to you, and we tell it to him and to him and to him and to them. And you know, by the time it gets back to us, everybody has heard something, and everybody has added a little or taken a little away, and they're carrying that particular campfire tale. And that's frankly what makes campfire tales interesting when you're a cam, is to see, because you told the story last year, and now you're back this year, and somebody's telling it again. Now there's two drunk uncles in a boat with no motor, and you know, blah blah blah. And it's like, where'd that come from? And it's like, well, what was the basis of it? Was that there were, you know, folks in a boat in danger, and that's, you know, that's the truth of the story, factually. And then everybody has their own experience of it, which we get to share with one another. So I think that can be helpful. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. A pleasure to be here, as always.
This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.